Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
And Bob Hill.
And today on the show, we've got hardy hibiscus.
Yep, dwarf ones.
Dwarf ones.
Little guys.
Specifically.
Yeah, and I've used them over in the past, and I do like them. I use them more and more because they come back, and they're pretty easy to grow, and they're durable. And
they really are.
And they're workhorses.
They are, and they're really showy, tropical.
Yeah, they're like jockeys. They're little guys around there.
Yeah.
But they're really kind of neat.
Big, nice blooms like you're in Hawaii.
Yeah, and then to go with that, we have a big picture kind of guy.
We do. Hugh Raffles has recently published a book called Insectopedia. He's gotten quite a bit of media attention with it. And it's a cool book because it's not what you think.
No.
You don't open it up and it's like this list of A, B, C, D that tells you about insects.
No.
It's like essays, stories, experiences. Some chapters are long, some are short, some are vignettes, some are really just musings about different insects and people that dealt with them.
Yeah, it zigs and zags in a marvelous and human way. I mean, you turn a page and there's a surprise there. Things you don't normally think associate with insects and people or culture or what's going on in the world.
I was pretty wrapped with it, yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff.
This might give some perspective on it. He's an anthropologist.
Oh, yeah.
And I think, you know, his desire to sort of understand people and their connection to their surroundings has evolved into this people and insects, which then got him to study insects a little bit more. Do you know what I mean?
But then, like, just the one long chapter, fascinating, on cricket fighting.
Yeah.
And the culture of cricket fighting and how tens of thousands of people will raise crickets and gather and bet on them and fight.
It's been going on for thousands of years. Yeah.
And I've never heard of it before.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very serious.
Yeah. Well, we'll ask him about it. It's pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Oh, yeah.
So that's coming up today on Homegrown. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
No cricket fighting, to my knowledge.
No. Probably some crickets here and there.
It's kind of a study in contrast this time here. I have this Asiatic lilies, which I really like. Talk about screaming colors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not just the real fragrant ones, but the shorter ones and the bright yellows and the pinks and the whites. And I just love those things. And as kind of a counterpoint to that, I've got about 20 or 25 of those little blue elfin grasses in one area.
Mm-hmm.
Just beautiful, airy, light blue grass. It's kind of off by itself. And it's just, in my mind, I love the contrast of the two. I like to go over here
and airy and then more.
Yeah, then here's the screaming colors. They're not they're not near each other because that'd be a little too much. It would kind of take away from each one of them. But just the contrast available if you think about it and find the right kind of plants.
Mm-hmm.
How about the Wish You Stay? What's up?
And the twist of fate that nature often delivers.
or the fox takes away.
I go back to plant my Tavera green beans, you know, those French filet beans that I love so much, and I'm standing at the end of my row because you know how it's mulched around, and I look down right next to my foot and I'm like, that looks pretty deliberate. What's that? It was a swirl of pine straw and fir.
Uh-oh.
So I push it aside, and right in the middle of my vegetable garden, at the end of my bean row, are 8 baby bunnies.
Staying close to the food, were they?
Mama is one smart rabbit.
Yes.
So we've been, and of course, you know, I have to protect them from my own dog because I'm not letting my dog kill baby bunnies.
No.
When they get older, they can be fair game.
So you keep the dog out of the fence
scenario? Out of the fence scenario. Or if he comes in, I have this nice heavy wooden crate that had, you know, bulbs in it.
Oh, yeah.
And I put the crate over top because Mama just comes back in the evening.
Over the dog or over the bunnies?
Over the bunnies. Actually, Buck probably wouldn't mind it because it's shade.
Yeah, right.
So he just sits there by it and, you know, stares at it. But over the course of the last week, Bob, there were 8 teeny baby bunnies in this, nest. But over the course of the week, there are only 5 bunnies in there now.
Uh-oh.
And there's no disturbance or anything. So I don't know if a baby might die and then Mama removes the, you know what I'm saying? So there's no evidence of any sort of activity that would suggest. I mean, and plus if somebody found the nest, they would kill everybody, wouldn't they?
They can't hop through the fence.
Yeah, and they're not big enough to even do that yet. And they can't, they can go through the fence easy.
Oh.
Yeah. Because it's, you know, that big cattle fence.
Out looking for Easter maybe or something.
So yeah, we'll see what happens.
No.
But baby bunnies right in the middle of the vegetable garden and I can't do a thing about it.
There's a Disney movie at your place.
It is.
Between the foxes, the bunnies, the chickens.
I just can't Yeah, we've got some sort of good habitat going on for somebody.
I guess. Right.
So keep your finger. I planted my bean seeds, and then I covered them with this nice little netting tunnel thing.
Oh yeah.
So that should protect them until they get big enough.
We just covered our blueberries in the same fashion. Mm-hmm. So okay. Yeah.
All right. So that's what's going on. Let's see what's going on around town. Bob and I were talking about how all the farmers markets are. Many of them opened in May, but many of the big ones are opening this weekend or last weekend. So do try to check your local scene, because there are so many. I mean, there's a couple in Jeffersonville.
I'm sure Floyd County has mm-hmm. them, and you know, both sides of the river. And
yeah, I was in fact in New Albany just yesterday. It was their opening day for the farm market that they have there, which is at Sam's Food and Spirit. So, you know, most of them take place from 9 to noon, that sort of thing. I recently picked up some meat CSA that I did from Adam Barr's farm. That's a market on Market Street, Bob.
Yeah.
And that market is on Tuesdays from 3:30 to 6:30. You know, so like they've got markets everywhere at different times on different days, really to cater to the needs of the people.
Oh, yeah.
So check them out. We do have a list of some of the Louisville farmers markets on our website, or a link to it at wfpl.org. But, you know, you might want to check your Kentucky or Indiana Department of Agriculture as well. And one other event, fair season's coming around too, Bob.
Yeah.
The Bullitt County Fair's taking place in June. And on the 19th, I'll be out there talking to folks from 1 to 2:30. So come visit us if you're in that area and are ready for some fair activities.
You think they'll have any dwarf hibiscus out there?
I bet you they will.
They should.
You know, I would think that would be a favorite for flower competitions and displays.
And we have just the person to talk about that. It's Gretchen Zwetzig. She's owner of Fleming's Flower Fields, a retail and wholesale mail order nursery that hybridizes, grows, and sells dwarf hardy hibiscus and crepe myrtle. She's with us today to talk about both and the history of the company. Gretchen, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you, Bob.
Yeah, well, it was kind of fun to find you because I've heard about these legendary Fleming brothers, Jim, Bob, and Dave of Nebraska for many years, and you actually got to work with them. So kind of catch us up on your background and how you met the Flemings.
Well, it's kind of funny. I was actually working on a master's degree in cultural anthropology, and I don't know how happy I was with continuing with that, for sure. So I decided to get a gardening job, which a lot of my friends had, and I went to the job service. And they referred me to the brothers. And I got a call, talked to them on the phone about coming out to work, and it took me a little while to figure out. I didn't just have one Fleming brother on the phone. I had two. I had both Bob and Dave.
Oh, my gosh. Well, tell us about the brothers. What were they like?
Well, it's you know, first I always want to say they were very sweet and very kind, but that just sounds, you know, like something you would say, but they really were. They were also really hardy themselves. They were kind of surprisingly sweet, though, you know, and tough. You know, they were, for example, Jim and Bob actually landed on the shores of Omaha Beach and survived that.
Uh-huh.
And yet, when they told me when I met them that they were pacifists, and it took me a long time to figure out that they had actually done that, because they were kind of that contradiction. They were really tough, but they were actually, you know, really sweet mm-hmm. underneath it. So, yeah.
You now own the business, yes? So
yes.
You started working with them out of school, but uh-huh. you know, clearly evolved
yes.
to take over the business. So Fleming yes. Flowers Fields is your business now.
Yes, it is. It's something I inherited from Jim and Dave,
mm-hmm.
and it's something that grew, and it grew very naturally. The brothers and I just, I think personality-wise, had a lot in mm-hmm. common, and had a lot of fun together, and I was drawn to those plants more strongly than I knew,
yeah.
and it just grew and grew, and then
and they recognized
basically,
it.
You know, grew into something that they wanted me to inherit and mm-hmm. keep going.
That's great.
Let's talk about the hibiscus itself. Why should people have it?
I think people should have it because, yes, I'm biased, but I think it's definitely one of the most exciting perennials out there. it brings a whole new light to perennials, really, and shows just how bold and colorful and tropical that they can look in, you know, a Midwestern or Eastern garden, especially.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with the Fleming's addition of the purple leaves and bringing the size down to that 3 foot on average, and then the amount of detail that they put into these is really striking when you have one. And so I think it's a spotlight in the garden. I think it's something that would really brighten any garden up.
So, Gretchen, what kinds of things did you all have to do over the years to shrink them in size, create these interesting details that you speak of?
Well, I wish I could take credit, but I can't take credit for that.
Mm-hmm.
the shrinking part, that was something that the Flemings worked on, I would say, starting in like the 50s mm-hmm. on. They just worked on hardy hibiscus, and they were so ahead of their time. They knew before I think anyone had thought about it, you know, but this happens with other hybridizers, but they knew they wanted to get that height down from the, you know, 6 to 10 foot
mm-hmm.
and make it something that could actually be in the landscape and, of course, add those colorful details.
So do you just keep selecting every year from plants that maybe
yeah.
seem a little bit shorter, and then replant those? Did they collect seeds? Did they take cuttings? A little
yep.
bit of both?
Well, all of that.
Okay.
All of that and more. I
mm-hmm.
think that, you know, those were some of the stories that were almost exhausting, because to hear them tell how many generations, you know, went into each of these hybrids, and, you know, so much of it off the top of their head, we crossed this and this, and, you know, multiple mm-hmm. crosses and selections and
okay.
seedlings and cuttings every year.
All right.
Give us a verbal picture of what those fields look like. Were there big greenhouses or acres of hibiscus in various stages of size or what?
Well, you know, it's funny, especially with the hybridizing part, you do need a lot of room, you know, at least an acre or so. And the Fleming's, the place I worked at in Lincoln, it was almost 2 acres. But at the same time, you don't need as much room as you think when you are master hybridizers like they were, and you've already selected down over the years and know exactly what you're hybridizing for. The picture that comes to mind for me is like when I would show up to work every day in Nebraska and think about this hard winter and show up, and I would go and you'd see all these thousands of hardy hibiscus blooming, and I thought, this is better than Hawaii. No
yeah.
doubt in my mind,
oh, yeah.
and I've actually been there since, but yeah, that's what it looked like, was better than Hawaii.
Wow. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the introductions, some of the details of the specific plants, cultivar names, et cetera?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, the big one that everybody knows that really put, I think, hardy hibiscus and the Flemings on the map as far as for the future
mm-hmm.
was Copper King.
Right.
And, you know, it has a very bold, solid red maple leaf. It has a 12-inch white flower with red and hot pink streaks to the edges. I mean, it's about as stunning as a plant can be. And that was introduced in 1999-2000.
Okay.
And from there, we had a series of groundbreaking hybrids, really, in that they had a yellow color break with Fantasia. They had the purple color break in hardy hibiscus, and then you have the purple leaves of Plum Crazy. And then we've progressed. We've had many come out over the years with some of these same characteristics, but all very unique, and then leading up to our new Fleming Dwarf Hibiscus,
okay.
which have been, you know, in testing for 10 years.
Okay, what? Give us some of the best dwarfs. Sleepy, Dot,
boy,
Grumpy.
Tempting to name them that, but I would say, well, and they are the seven dwarves. We've got seven we introduced
in
2011, so we call them that. But Copper Queen is really stunning, and it, of course, harkens back to Copper King,
right.
but I wouldn't say a short version of Copper King, because we wouldn't introduce something that looked just too close to another. It's got the red leaf, but it's more of almost a bronze leaf, and it's 2.5 feet, and then it has a white flower with red streaks, but they're very dark streaks that almost make the flower look red
wow.
a lot of times, because there's so many of them.
Right.
So It's stunning. And then, of course, we have Small Wonder, which has the darkest purple leaf I've ever seen, and it's almost black. It's so purple. And also has a lot of streaks and markings. I mean, you can see how I like to go into detail on these. They're like talking about candy or something. Yeah. There's so many good ones.
So the devil's in the detail, it sounds like. Are there any sort of cultural things that people need to consider, Gretchen, as they grow hardy hibiscus? I mean, clearly they're hardy. You mentioned that some of these can go to below 30. But what else do we need to keep in mind throughout the growing season?
Well, besides the 30 below, that's kind of another trademark with the Flemings and the purple leaves and that. The things with them are... And I guess I should speak primarily for the Flemings, what I know about those in particular, is they're adaptable, we've found, all across the country. So I've even grown them in Ventura, California, and they just adjust themselves and bloom a little later when it gets the hottest in their season. But the main thing with them is, and what's so great about them, is you plant them, you water them in good so they're almost muddy, and you let them go. And when you know they're really dry is when they're going to need water, because they have tap roots that can go down 10 feet, 10 foot to collect water. So they're really drought resistant, and they also can handle a lot of water. So they're just very adaptable.
Now, if you prune them back, can you get them very dwarf?
Well, you sure can, and I know the Flemings always said you can prune them all you want. As long as you don't prune them back past, you know, 5 leaves per branch, you can cut them back as much as you'd like.
And then fall, you just cut them off and they'll be back in the spring, right?
You know, it depends on your situation. I leave mine till spring if I have a field of them.
Okay.
But yeah, in a landscape, you can cut them back as soon as those branches have gone dormant and turned brown. They stay green at the base of the branches, but you can cut them back a few inches whenever you like.
Sort of treat them as any other herbaceous perennial, huh?
Will they sucker like an Asiatic lily or spread out over the years?
Actually, they're similar to tubers in that they do add on, and you can, you know, they create more
clumps,
clones or divisions over the years.
Although they're really tough to divide, aren't they?
Yeah, I don't think it's for the average gardener to go out and,
without a chainsaw.
Unless you like digging up trees.
Yeah.
But then you also done work on crepe myrtles in Nebraska, which is surprising. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, those are great plants, and I always think of Bob Fleming with the crepe myrtles, because that was kind of his project over the years. And he, many years ago, secured some seed from another hybridizing friend up north. And he just went from there. Since the late 40s on, he worked on, again, single-mindedly knowing what he wanted to create, a dwarf crepe myrtle. Of course, that's also very floriferous, and, you know, the Flemings being perfectionist, it has beautiful branching as well.
But they die back to the ground in Nebraska or not?
Yes. And depending on where you're at, these are also really adaptable. We grow them in California. They're wonderful. Yes, they die back, but then depending on where you're at, they might sprout from the bottom of the branches, too, or they might just come up from the ground, or you can have a combination.
Yeah. And we could actually...
Kind of a perennial, kind of a shrub.
Right. And we could potentially get them to come back here in Kentucky compared to... Your harsher winters.
Yeah. These are hardy to 30 below as well, and for the size, it's pretty surprising how tough these little buggers are.
Great.
Anything else you're working on in the crepe myrtle or hibiscus family, that size
and
color?
We're always working on the crepe myrtle. We're always working on the hardy hibiscus, and with the hardy hibiscus, we're focused on the Fleming dwarf hibiscus to be something that continues. And, of course, the Fleming brothers were able to get some of the Rosa sinensis, or the tropical hibiscus, just a small amount of the genetics introduced into the Machutos hybrids. And so that is something we focus on as well, because that's really the future. That's the way to introduce a lot more colors. We actually had those genetically tested, so, you know, kind of proved it to ourselves. Those are something we focus on, and then also we're working on introducing a Caryopteris this next year. Mm-hmm. It's related to one, the Flemings. The Flemings put out the first blue-flowered Caryopteris, so that's something we've been working on. And, you know, who knows what else.
We'll keep it coming, Gretchen.
We'll stay in touch. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you much.
Gretchen Zwetzig is the owner of Fleming's Flower Fields, a retail and wholesale mail-order nursery that hybridizes, grows, and sells dwarf hardy hibiscus and crepe myrtle. For more information on Gretchen or Fleming's Flower Fields, visit the homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got Hugh Raffles and his new book, Insectopedia. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
And Bob Hill.
And I think I have somebody in the running to be maybe my favorite nature writer.
Wow.
You know, because Bern Heinrich is my favorite. And reading Insectopedia, I had that same sort of enjoyment, I guess. They have different styles of writing, to be sure, but I had that same sort of enjoyment, you know?
Yeah, I like
the
book.
Good storyteller.
Yeah, he was a good storyteller, and it surprised you.
Yeah.
Not many books will surprise you anymore, or one like this especially.
Yeah.
You think you know where it's going, and all of a sudden, it's not.
Yeah, a bunch of different stories.
Yeah, chronicles the worst and the best of human nature, human beings, human history.
And insects.
With insects.
Yeah.
It makes it all fit.
It really does, and it's, you know, historical and contemporary and all of that. And it is the kind of book you can enjoy at various times, don't you think? You could just pick up and read an entry, a chapter.
Oh, yeah.
And then put it back down
In
and read it, you know.
I think I'd almost have to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I could absorb all this and do it justice.
Yeah.
Going A to Z.
Yeah. I love it. So I'm delighted to be able to. I'm delighted that I was able to read it, and I'm delighted that we can speak with Hugh Raffles now. He is joining us. Hugh is the chair of the anthropology department at the New School of Social Research. He has degrees in Latin American studies and forestry and a deep interest in the study of insects and people, which he now shares in his book, Insectopedia. This book is not what you think. Especially just looking from the outside, as Bob said.
Not even close.
Instead, Insectopedia is a collection of essays, meditations, stories, and experiences, and it's written in an award-winning prose, which is always nice. So, Hugh, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Janine. It's great to be here.
Sure. The underlying theme, I think, of the whole book, and, you know, your essays, vignettes, meditations, longer stories, that sort of thing, throughout Insectopedia is the relationship between humans and insects and the attitudes that prevail and why they prevail, I think. Are you trying to educate and convince people otherwise that we don't need to like kill an insect or hate an insect by instinct?
I think so. I mean, I'm not really trying to educate anybody. I suppose I just would like people to just reflect a little bit.
Yeah.
So what I think of myself as doing really is just opening some questions and asking people to maybe slow down a little. Yeah. So not react so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose really what I found is that thinking about insects and people's relationships to them is a way into thinking about a whole range of situations and questions about our relationship with the wider world, and just the way we live our lives, the way we interact with nature, with each other, and with animals, I suppose, particularly in general.
Yeah, I mean, and just to sort of reemphasize your, you know, more of an anthropological sort of approach than an entomological sort of approach, you know?
Yeah, and I really don't claim particular expertise with insects. Most of what I know about them is in the book, to be honest.
Yeah.
When I started out, I really didn't know much except that insects were very fascinating, and so writing a book seemed like a great opportunity to learn more about them.
Mm-hmm. Selfish. Selfish intent. That's always good, though.
Now, talk about the organization of the book. I mean, you made some fascinating trips to China to watch cricket matches and all around the world. How did you lay it out? Did they just kind of follow one another, or serendipity leads you from here to there from time to time?
Yeah, there's a lot of serendipity, and it has this alphabetical structure. And part of that was because I was thinking a lot about how our knowledge of the natural world is organized and the way that we, I mean, I think we have no choice really, but the way that we try to systematize and classify the natural world in different ways. And it seemed, and the more I thought about it, the more, I don't know, I want to say crazy, but crazy is not the right word, but just how impossible it seemed maybe, mm-hmm. you know, to organize everything in an encyclopedia or in some other form of organization, because there's just so much and we have so little ability to understand just the enormity of what's out there.
Well, it sort of reflects like what you wrote about, or, you know, some, I think it was somebody else who actually spoke of it in Japan maybe, or in China. But how can you trust somebody who only wears a lab coat and studies insects in a laboratory? You know, this person needed to be in nature and observing it there. So a traditional encyclopedia sort of keeps us just with the facts instead of with the experiences, the human interaction.
Yeah, and I do think that facts are important, and I think we've learned an enormous amount through scientific forms of and methods of explanation and investigation. But it's really only one way into understanding mm-hmm. the world, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And I'm also interested in the ways that artists have approached insects, and actually, you know, in one case, musicians mm-hmm. and philosophers too. And that maybe if you can start thinking about a whole range of different forms of inquiry and ways of approaching, in some ways, approaching the mysteries of life, then you can have a richer understanding.
Yeah, you open the book in an interesting way, in that fashion, going back to 1926 when they made the first airplane flights with tape or glue or something attached to the plane to catch the insects. People had no idea up to then how far they would be carried by the winds, or they could be found at even 15,000 feet, wandering the world.
Yeah, I was very happy when I found that story. It's, as you say, it's from 1926 was the first time that people went up in planes to try to figure out at what altitude you'd find insects, and they really found, I think they found way more than they were bargaining for. Actually, mm-hmm. the people who were doing it worked for the Department of Agriculture, and they were trying to figure out the migratory routes of moths and weevils that were causing problems with the cotton crop. So they send up planes, and they had sticky traps on them, and they opened them at various altitudes for different periods of time, mm-hmm. and then they came down and counted what they got, and they were finding just huge amounts of insects in the air above Louisiana, actually. And they estimated that above 1 square mile, like in an air column, 1 square mile, that some say up to 14,000 feet, I think it was, above Louisiana, there'd be something like between 25 million and 35 million insects at any given time of day mm-hmm. or year. And you know, it was kind of shocking
if you've never thought about it before, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a bit overwhelming, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them died in the journey, which was kind of in a way a benefit, I guess, to the planet. If you had that many insects living all through this, would be a little different world.
But they, at the time, they thought the insects were just getting blown around, and then, you know, over subsequent decades, and particularly in the 70s, there was a whole new burst of research on this, and people started to figure out that actually insects were, and many of these insects are flightless insects. They're not insects with wings, or they're too small to have to be strong flyers otherwise, but they would be they would actually be able to leave when they wanted to leave and position themselves to come down when they wanted to, and they really had a lot of control over their flight and their destinations too, it seemed.
And because we can talk a little bit about this later too, the whole notion of swarming.
Yeah.
But these were not even really swarms necessarily, because it was a mixture of a whole bunch of different insects, right?
Exactly.
So it's really just sort of their highway. They knew how to manipulate
to
move.
I think it's really amazing, and it's something that we don't think about at all. And somebody writes about it as if the whole planet is under surveillance. Millions of, well, I suppose billions and billions of insects in the air at any given time, and they're all traveling somewhere.
Yeah.
And most of them it's very difficult. I wouldn't want to say they know where they're going, but they know how to they clearly know how to control their flight. Mm-hmm. They go up there and they know. Well, knowing is a difficult thing to talk about with insects, but yeah. They get themselves taken up. They organize themselves in relation to the currents, and they organize themselves to come down. And they're looking for. It appears that they're looking for new habitats. Mm-hmm. New sources of food or new mates or something like that.
Right.
You touched on that in the book. There's something going on beyond instinct.
For sure. I'm pretty sure about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hugh, yeah. I know that Bob and I don't know if this is a question that you get all the time and it wears you out, but honestly, that particular chapter read like a novel to me when you went to Shanghai. So you have to share, you know, some of the experience trying to learn more about the cricket trade, training, and fighting, because it was a fabulous tale that was true.
Yeah, and it was really, I think that was my favorite part of the book.
It has to be, yeah.
Probably shows, I think.
I think so.
What I didn't know before, I spent a little time in Shanghai looking at the, I don't know what you call it, whether you'd call it a sport or a hobby or a passion or whatever of cricket fighting, where people pit crickets against each other in a small plastic arena and really see which cricket wins. But there are people who, I mean, crickets don't just go into the arena and fight. People train the crickets and they care for them, and they've really been doing this for a long time. The first manuals of cricket training and cricket racing date back nearly 1,000 years in China.
Wow.
And people still refer to those, although they've really been updated, and they're constantly refining their skills and their their techniques. And it's really a very big thing in eastern China, particularly because, well, largely I think because there's so much money associated with it. There's a lot of money in gambling on crickets. So cricket fighting happens in because gambling's illegal, it happens in underground casinos, really, or sort of cricket fighting clubs, and people bet there. And depending on the kind of betting circle it is, the bets can really be an awful lot of money. So there's a lot of money that changes hands in just the betting part of it, and then there's a lot of money that changes hands in the trading and the buying and selling of crickets. So for a couple of months a year, when people are going out from Shanghai to Shandong, which is where most of the crickets come from. Now, there'll be tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people who'll travel to Shandong and buy crickets from local people there who've been collecting crickets and trading crickets in Shandong. So it will support the economy significantly support the economy in Shandong, and then a lot of tens of thousands probably of migrant workers will come from Shandong into Shanghai and will sell crickets in Shanghai. Mm-hmm. So there's a really important sort of commercial economy that's supported by it as well.
But culturally, there's argument for its importance as well, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, there's really this tremendous body of knowledge that people have, which is, I mean, to me, was really fascinating. And the kinds of relationships that people have developed with insects was really fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
Out of this relationship, and you find this in other places where people have close relationships with insects, there's something about the, I don't know what you'd call it, maybe temperament or attention that people get or develop from developing close relationships and really studying these very small animals. This isn't just my imagination. I think people really talk about this a lot, how they develop a different relationship with the world from really studying or just, I don't know what the word is, I'm sorry, it's hard for me to explain this. Somebody in Japan told me that through spending time with insects, he developed what he called mushy eyes, or insect eyes.
Uh-huh.
I really like that a lot. He said that you got the sensitivity to small things that then translated into your life in general. So you got more sensitive to differences between people,
uh-huh,
and to the ways that those matter, and to the sort of small changes in people's lives, and the ways that those things were important in people's in your relationship with people. But you also then really got to understand the way that large changes made small differences too.
Huh.
Well, you describe in the book when the fight began, it was like this profound silence in the room. Did you find yourself caught up in this moment also?
completely caught up, yeah. And when people have then said to me later, well, you know, you're so concerned about the way that animals get treated, and yet you're sitting here watching these crickets fight each other, and, you know, weren't you really bothered by that? And actually, in the moment, not at all. It's so engrossing. You know? And the crickets are so fascinating when you watch. It's very exciting.
I mean,
to
do they kill
fighting.
Each other normally?
Excuse me?
Do they kill each other? Or do...
Not really, no. Okay. Or I didn't actually see that.
Uh-huh.
When a cricket lives, and I think they can get wounded, I saw that.
Mm-hmm.
But when a cricket wins, it's really, really obvious. So it doesn't have to go to the death in that way. And I don't think it often does, so that may be wrong about that. But you know, a losing cricket, and this is one of the... Actually, this is something that people identify as a similarity between people and crickets. A losing cricket shows that it knows when it's lost, and it actually demonstrates some... You know, so it shows
a surrender of sorts.
Yeah, it really does. It looks all crestfallen, and it turns around and it retreats. And the winning cricket puffs up and looks very pleased with itself and starts to sing. And
very human-like.
Very human. There's no doubt about which is the winner. Yeah.
In Kentucky, the winners get to go to stud. What happens to the crickets?
You know, that doesn't happen. I thought that would happen, and it doesn't happen.
Actually, it seems like the losers win because they get set free.
I think the losers get recirculated and come back with a different identity because it's, you know, if they're in a whole different circuit, it's very hard to know that they've got this history. They come back with a whole different identity.
Are they named? Is there a Muhammad Ali of crickets that was retired and is revered across the...
Well, they don't live long enough for that to happen.
Okay.
And they don't get bred because people really think that it's the environment that gives them their qualities and... Mm-hmm. That, you know, they get their strength from growing up in a harsh environment. That's part of the reason, I think, why this part of the country in Shandong is so highly regarded.
Mm-hmm. It was a fascinating... There's so many more details to the tale, too, but it was a fascinating... the cultural part of it, the political part of it, the economic part of it, you know, everything. And just ultimately, like, that's what confuses you. Clearly, there's an enormous amount of respect for the cricket... You
That's
know,
right.
but
yeah.
it's a cricket fight, and it. But it's. But the. It, you, there's an enormous amount of respect for this little creature.
Another chapter fascinating me was the Kafka part, the Metamorphosis, the book, the story, I guess, and take us through that a little bit.
Well, one of the things that I don't write directly about Kafka, partly because I feel like everybody or many people already know the story of, you know, Gregor Samsa, who wakes up as some kind of animal. It's not clear what, but everybody thinks that it's a giant cockroach, and that kind of nightmare. But I thought about it a lot and started just thinking about that problem of being, both the problem of it, but also the fantastic mystery of it, that this animal can start off as one thing, as a caterpillar, and then go through this change where its whole body liquefies and it comes out as something completely different.
Yeah.
And that's really an abiding mystery that I think we might understand how it works genetically, but there's something about that transformation that's really, really hard to understand. It's not just that it's physically different, it's different in so many ways. So it starts as asexual and it comes out as sexual. It starts off as eating, you know, eating plants, and it comes out as just eating nectar.
Mm-hmm.
There's just this complete change that it goes through. And then as I was starting to try to understand this a bit more and read about it, I realized that there's no field guides, or actually, that's not quite true. The first one was published recently to caterpillars. So there's this complete obsession with butterflies and with moths and...
But not the part that comes first.
But there's nothing about the part that comes first, so it's almost as if it's like the child and the adult or something, but it doesn't count. I mean, we actually pay a lot of attention to children now, but it's as if this is somehow sort of irrelevant, except under I suppose it's pest control, that's when there's some attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really a completely different being. The continuity is very hard to identify.
Yeah. So almost smack dab in the middle of the book, under chapter M, called My Nightmares.
Yeah.
So, Hugh, what are your, as this person that's fascinated with people, as this person that's fascinated with living things, what are your most profound concerns that you have in terms of how we treat insects, and how maybe can we continue to get people to delight over seeing a spider instead of wanting to squish it?
Yeah, this is a great question. And when I first started the book, I really wasn't sure of where it was going to lead, but the more time that I spent with it, the more fascinated I've become with insects in two ways. I mean, one, because they're so mysterious and so just amazing, really simply just amazing. The more time you spend looking at them, the more wonderful they become, actually, and the more abilities you find, you discover that they have. So what I started to discover for myself, really, was that I think I changed as a person through writing this book and through really paying attention to these things, these beings that I really hadn't paid any attention to before. And I think doing it really opened my thinking in lots of ways. It made me much more willing to accept that there was a lot about the world that I don't understand and I'm not going to understand. Which doesn't mean that you just sit back and accept that there are things that are mysterious, therefore I'm not going to try to understand them. Mm-hmm. But I think that as you understand things, it's worth trying to understand things because you learn a lot. Mm-hmm. But you also learn that you learn a lot about there being more mysteries out there.
But it'll never really be complete, I suppose.
Yeah, and to accept that, I think, is actually a good thing. And to be willing to accept that there's a mysterious world out there that that we live in, and we should approach with a certain amount of humility, I think, mm-hmm. and not think that we can control it or even want to control it.
But just enjoy it.
But just enjoy it and be happy with that, and be happy with imperfection. I think is mm-hmm. a very important thing in life. Hmm. So that to me was an important thing I got out of this book. So insects are very powerful in that way,
yeah.
because they live in a separate world from us in many ways. I mean, we really condition their existence because we've done so much to change the planet, but they still live very independent lives from us, and we can learn a lot just from their independence, I think, and mm-hmm. from accepting that we live with them, and they live alongside us, and they have their own independent lives. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much, Hugh. We certainly enjoyed the book, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed talking. Thank you.
Hugh Raffles is the author of Insectopedia, published by Pantheon. He's also the chair of the anthropology department at the New School for Social Research and the 2009 recipient of the Whiting Writings Award. He spoke to us from his office at the New School. Of course, for more information on Dr. Hugh Raffles and Insectopedia, please go to our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and Miss Wishy's new Latin Word of the Week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown.
Bob Hill with questions.
All right.
Janine Wishy with answers. Okay. Well, I'm going to answer one this week, too.
Okay.
I've turned the new, it's my New Year's vow here, taken
to
in
focus.
June.
To focus.
Well, I'm always focused in my own scatterbrain.
Okay. In your own way.
Reverent. Lost sort of way.
By
yeah.
your own definition.
Miss Wishy.
Yes.
This is from a person named Pat.
All right.
I am trying to prepare for the onslaught of Japanese beetles. For the last 3 years, they have eaten to death my hollyhocks and done damage to my red twig dogwood and really munched out my rose of Sharon, which I love and have babied. Help! What can I do that is ecologically friendly to protect my plants from those beetles' mouths?
Oh, we should have been able to consult. Hugh needs a Japanese beetle story in his book, doesn't he, Insectopedia?
Yeah.
Japanese beetles, they're not as bad as they used to be.
No, they're territorial, geographic.
Yeah, they pretty much, well, they've kind of dissipated
yes.
As they've moved this way. Yeah. And they literally, Bob, they seem to always show up like right around June 16th. And we don't have that much of a problem with them anymore. But from time to time, they'll, you know, eat up the Virginia creeper, or they like the cannas last yeah. year that were in my pots. And Pat, this is what I do. I get a little bucket of water and put a little like Dawn dishwashing detergent in it. And I just leave it wherever your problem is. Just leave your bucket there all the time. In the morning when you're having your tea or your coffee and it's still cool out and they're still a little lethargic and not moving about yet, you go with your bucket and you hold it underneath the leaf where they're sitting and you tap the leaf and they all fall into the soapy water into the bucket. And you do that every morning, and that will help reduce your populations, right? Ecologically friendly. Another thing that you can do, and you would do this in the fall of the year, is control them by using something called milky spore. And milky spore has been around for a very long time, and it's a natural occurring bacteria. And you would apply it to your lawn on a cloudy day in maybe mid to late September, early October. The eggs have been laid and the grubs are actively feeding, you know, near the surface of the soil. The bacteria will then interact with and kill the grubs, but you have to do it in that grub stage. So you don't have, you might need to use the bucket this year, but you can do some control measures this fall for next year.
Yeah, point being, and people don't realize this, that the grubs live in your lawn.
Mm-hmm.
You don't associate Japanese beetles and grubs in your lawn at some point,
mm-hmm.
but that's where they are.
That the child stage. But, you know, yeah. They may fly in from your neighbor who doesn't treat their lawn. So sometimes we just have to accept these things that for not being as terrible as we think.
I have a no beetle zone.
Mm-hmm. How did you manage that?
They don't fly in. I put an X Japanese beetles and they don't. They just don't.
You got lucky.
They don't show up.
You got lucky.
No, I got them.
Okay. This is from Celia. When and how is wisteria pruned? Should the seed pods be cut off now? And then also similar questions in terms of a lavender plant and a rosemary plant that she has in a pot.
Huh. Well, wisteria, I did some research on this because I was curious myself. You prune it twice a year to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
You prune it once in the summer, after it blooms. After it blooms.
Mm-hmm.
And then midwinter, you hit it again and prune it way back mm-hmm. to maybe 5 or 6 buds
because
it'll bloom on last year's growth.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you have to do it twice. And if you do that, you'll finally get some wisteria blooms. I know people that have had them for years with no blooms.
And you want to prune like those little lateral shoots back to those 3, 4, 5 buds that he was talking about. So that's where you're making your pruning cuts. You've got your long main trunk and then all the little parts that come off of it. Those are the ones you want to keep pruning back, pruning, tip pruning basically, and then you'll force it into bloom.
Sort of like grapes a little bit.
And keep it under control.
The same kind of thing, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
But people don't realize you have to do it twice.
Yeah.
Almost nobody knows that.
And even if you did it once, that's an improvement.
Yeah.
But twice is going to be superstar.
In my case, 6 times might be the best.
Nothing left.
No.
All right, she's wondering about her lavender plant and her rosemary plant as well. And right now, it's not really the best time to prune them. Usually what you would do is prune them in the early spring before any new growth comes.
Right.
And I usually would just kind of shape the lavender plant, you know, like a little bowl haircut, basically, maybe remove about a third. Because if you remove too much of that woody sort of plant, like rosemary and lavender, you shock it too much and you can kill it. So a third in spring.
What I did find is if you don't do it, you're going to have a mess on your hands.
Mm-hmm.
You got to prune it back some.
Yeah.
Or
yeah. You can do a little, you know, a little snipping here and there now, but early spring's the best time, Celia. All right. If you have a question, you can get a hold of us in various ways.
At the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, there more and more late in the afternoon, I find myself guilty of aggravated
cernium. Yeah, that's a good,
aggravated cernium. Every about 4 or 5 o'clock, I need some cernium.
I'm a 4 o'clock cernium, too.
Cernium.
I am.
Cernium,
All right, Latin word of the week this week. Cernus, cernia, or cernium, which means nodding or drooping.
Yeah, you betcha.
Very good, Bob.
Hey.
Allium cernum.
The nodding onion.
Nodding onion. Lilium cernum.
The nodding lily. That sounds cool. A nodding lily. Yeah. I like thought of that.
There's a theme here.
Yeah.
Trillium cernum.
The nodding trillium.
Sasa cernium.
The nodding sasa.
What's sasa?
I don't know. It's
bamboo.
Your show again.
Sasa vecchiae.
Oh,
yeah.
Sure.
So it's going to be a sasa, like a grassy, shorter bamboo, right?
Anything needs to nod off, it's bamboo.
Has some sort of nodding characteristic.
Yeah.
Biden's cernia.
The nodding beggar tick.
Who can, you know, resist that?
Yeah.
Spiranthes cernia.
The nodding ladies' tresses.
Ladies' tresses. I've been searching for a little patch of ladies' tresses that we've noticed in the prairie in the past, but I haven't found her quite yet this year after the big burn, so I'm not sure if it's Spiranthes cernia or something else, but it is a ladies' tresses.
I might have said ladies' tresses, which is a little different animal.
Ladies' Tresses. There we go. All right, so if you see Syrnus, Syrnia, or Syrnium, something about that plant will be nodding or drooping, just like Bob Hill at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Homegrown is produced by the always upright Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.